Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Well, this week we're going to talk about a number of different subjects. We're going to talk about Partygate, we're going to talk about sexting, we're going to talk about the horrific murder of Sir David Ames, and we're also going to talk about the conviction of Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, a horrific story. Let's start, first of all, we're visiting this story yet again, but we've now got some conclusion to some degree, but very unsatisfactory.
No. What the police are doing, if you remember, the Met Police weren't very keen on investigating these breaches of the COVID laws, but they belatedly, when Sue Gray was about to publish a report, decided to investigate. And they're now doing it event by event. And so they've identified various events at which people were attended and decided to determine whether or not they had breached the regulations and then issue a fixed penalty notice. And we've learnt that the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, the Prime Minister's wife, and others are now receiving fixed penalty notices. And the reaction widely, particularly from those of us who've lost somebody during the pandemic, has been quite telling. Actually, we think that we've said before, the whole point of our podcast is without fear or favour, but seemingly there were certain people for whom favours were being offered, people who were allowed to break the rules without major consequences. And the reaction, as I said, from the wider public has been quite appalling. Actually, they want some consequences, and the Prime Minister, particularly, and the Chancellor as well, have made it very clear that they're not going to resign. That as far as they're concerned, this is a mistake that they made, and that they will want us all to move on. The problem with that, of course, is that the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, etc., they made these rules. And those of us who had to comply, we didn't make them. But so we expect, do we not, Mark, our leaders to at least...
And that's the heart of this, isn't it, Nizzy? I mean, yeah. Let's look at the facts. So we now know that the Metropolitan Police has made 50 referrals to the Criminal Records Office. This is the office that issues the fixed penalty notices for breaches of COVID-19 regulations. It's tied up Johnson and others. Mr. Johnson told the House back some months ago that no rules had been broken in relation to the parties, and that they had been... as far as he's concerned, no breaches. Now, of course, we now know that not to be true. And it'd be interesting to get your thought process in a minute. Is that a breach of ministerial code? Has he lied to the House?
Yeah.
But furthermore, and this goes to the heart of it, is that Mr. Johnson, whilst he's offered a full apology, that apology has little meaning, because he's then added to it that he says, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. This is a man who set the rules. This is a man who went on television, who set out to the public what isn't acceptable. He is saying he did not know those rules. Astonishing.
Well, first up, you know, and I know that the ignorance of the law is no defence. You know, I can't imagine how many defenders have turned up in a courtroom and said, well, I didn't know what I was doing was a crime. And the judges have always said, I don't care. The crime, you know, law is the law, and you broke the law. And I think that, what can I say? It's just mind-blowing. And it demonstrates, does it not, almost contempt.
Do you think he breached ministerial codes and lied to the House?
Of course he did. I mean, he said, I'm sure if we go back through Hansard, which is, for those of us people don't know, that's the parliamentary record, there were many occasions in which he said, the rules were complied with. Well, no. If you pay the fixed penalty notice, you accept the rules were not complied with. And I think that, if anything, sadly, that is probably the worst thing. You know, we expect a higher standard from those who lead us. At the very least, we expect them to tell the truth to Parliament, where they are meant to be held to account. And here we have a catalogue of occasions in which the Prime Minister and others have said that they complied when they clearly did not comply. And, you know, what is... You know, the number of times I've applied for public sector jobs, Mark, and it says you have to comply with the Nolan principles about truth and honesty and integrity. And it talks about the fact that you have a higher responsibility than any other member of the public to act responsibly and lawfully and truthfully. And the person who is responsible for the ministerial code, the Prime Minister, has not done that. I mean,
and
that
Nazir,
really
let's look at this personally. So, like many, you lost someone very dear to you during this period of time, and you've been very open in terms of the horrific nature of what you went through, and it's very emotional. How do you feel about the very man who set out those rules?
Do you know
that period of time?
On the 8th of April, 2020, I learnt in the middle of the morning that my brother had passed away. I was at home all alone. There were, at that time, people may remember, community testing did not happen, so you weren't able to test yourself. He was not tested. He was sick. He was ill. He died. The first thing I did was cry. But the second thing I did was to go online, check the government website to see what the rules were. And the rules were a certain number of people can go to a funeral. The rules were in an emergency, you're able to go and help somebody, support somebody. So I made sure that whatever I did, and by the way, I didn't go to the funeral, whatever I did complied with the law at the time. When our Prime Minister says he did not know what the laws were, when he, as you said a moment ago, he put them in place, for crying out loud, it angers me, it annoys me, and there are tens of thousands of people who are absolutely, appalled by what's happened.
And what do you think about the level of fines? So I did a bit of research yesterday looking at the levels of fines given to different people, and of course they all vary. I found quite a number of £10,000 fines given to organisers of events, but there were also lots of fines of £1,000 given to individuals who have breached. This is a fine of £50. Okay, it's been reduced because of the early payment of it. Pathetic.
It is. I remember back then, I don't know if you remember, there was a party in Brixton, and these young men decided to come together and have a party, and they ended up getting thousands of pounds worth of fines. And we were all going, how terrible they are that they did what they did. This is quite right, they get that level of penalty. The other thing people were saying was presumably they're going to put this fine on parliamentary expenses, and not actually pay out of their own pockets. It's a terrible outcome to a terrible situation, but it damages confidence in the whole justice system that one group of people will be treated as differently as
they have been. Where do you think an individual's morality sits in relation to this? I mean, I'd struggle hugely knowing, well, first of all, that I was in that scenario, not allowed to do it, so I wouldn't do it. But if I did end up doing it, where does that morality end up sitting when we've got these very people who are leading the country?
That's the thing, and I keep questioning, really, is that it doesn't matter whether something was lawful or not. Actually, it was unlawful what he did, but it was immoral too. I mean, it sends out this terrible message. Who's going to believe him now? If God forbid, there's another major outbreak of the pandemic and we're going back into lockdown, who's going to believe? Who's going to say, well, I will comply? When they've learned that actually during the last one, at the time when we were most scared, in the first lockdown, our leaders did not comply. I think it has a devastating effect on public health compliance. It has a devastating effect on public confidence. And absolutely, the moral case outstanding here. He did not do anything that could remotely be seen as being moral in these circumstances. We will bear the consequences for a long time. I can imagine, Mark, people will be in court on a regular basis in the months and years to come saying, well, I did not know what the law was in relation to anything, any crime. I didn't know what the law was, or I didn't comply. Well, why should I be treated any differently to the Prime Minister? We take our lead from our leaders. That's what the word means. And I'm sure that it has had a crushing effect on people's confidence in the justice system, full stop.
So do you think Johnson and Rishi Sunak should go?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Sunak, to be honest, because he took a long, long time to respond after the FPN, probably was reflecting upon it and thinking, maybe he should. But at the end of the day, they put their own job before country. And I think that, you know, the other issue about, well, we're at war right now. Well, we're not at war, actually. And by the way, when we were at war in the Second World War, our Prime Minister was replaced. You know, when we were at war in the First World War, our Prime Minister was replaced. Really at war. So I don't buy that, you know, we're at war and therefore we should stay in place. Actually, when you're at war, that's when you need to have confidence in your leaders.
Yeah.
And we don't have confidence.
That's when you need a leader, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm sure this will rumble on and we'll end up talking about it again. Let's look at sexting. Sexting we alluded to last week. The law in relation to sexting relates to the Protection of Children's Act 1978. I've used it many, many times during my policing career. And it relates to the sending, creating, possessing, making of an indecent image of anyone under the age of 18. And it's an offence to take that picture and obviously then subsequently to possess it or to pass it on. What is obviously interesting in relation to that is that it's legal once you've attained the age of 16 over that age to have sex. But of course, you can't take an image of it and share it and have it. Mm. That has created some kind of confusion to many. But the British police, I know, have taken a very clear stance on that, and they are not looking to use that to criminalise youngsters. In a way, sexting has become a way of life for young people.
Yeah. I mean, the figures, the stats from organisations like the National Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children and others are quite devastating, actually. Something like 70% of young girls between the age of 12 and 18 say that they were sent pictures of male genitalia by others. 70%. I mean, not talking 7%. You know, it's become almost a daily, well, hourly occurrence for some of our children to receive that kind of imagery. And then, you know, they are bullied about it. They are harassed about it. There are other instances of people who are, well, you know, why do you report this, for crying out loud? You know, this is all part of growing up. It's nonsense. It's a crime. It's criminal. And it sends out this terrible message somehow about what you can do and what you can't do. And it's sort of, again, we talked about morality earlier on. You know, is it immoral to do this and to say share this kind of material? Are we sending out a really strong message here? We're not. We're simply allowing it to happen on a daily basis, hourly basis, without any consequences. And I despair, actually, at what young people are having to experience these days.
But I suppose one of the problems with it is that you and I day, there wasn't mobile phones, so the capturing of images in the immediacy wasn't there. It is now. And as a result of that, children will naturally experiment. That's what happens. You know, children push the boundaries. They try those things that sometimes get them into trouble, sometimes doesn't. But of course, the consequences of capturing an image are potentially forever.
Absolutely. You can't delete it anymore. I mean, the idea that, you know, all right, you know, you might burn the picture if it was taken on a Kodak maybe 20 years ago. Now it's out there online for the rest of your life and will be shared and will be photoshopped and it will be worse and worse and worse.
And I guess that's the problem, is that whilst the initial taking of that image and the sharing of the image might be totally innocent and it might be within the boundaries and perimeters of just sharing a photograph, the problem is that we're dealing with young children. We're dealing with people who are immature, and therefore, as a result of that, their feelings change. And what sadly happens is far too often those images then get shared with other people. And therein is the problem.
Yeah, it is. You lose control of the image. If it was your image that you showed to one person, that would be fine, and it wasn't electronic. Now you lose control, and it will be used against you literally for the rest of your life, and will plague the rest of your life. And I think that's something we don't have. We talked lots before about educating young people. This is an area, quite frankly, where we are failing big time. In not really getting young people to understand what it is.
Do you think we need to do more to educate youngsters? Yeah. Do we need to do more to educate parents? I mean, I think one of the things that is very clear is that children are far more advanced in technology than parents are. And it often means that parents get left behind because they don't know how to have those conversations. And we've got to be having those conversations with children when they're young. You know, it's no point having a conversation with your child when they're 11 or 12. You've got to be having these conversations with children when they're 5 or 6. Start those conversations, age appropriate, at those stages.
I mean, there's a people, young children will have smartphones from the age of 6 or 7, won't they? Yeah. And if a parent does not know what they're doing, what they're receiving, what they're sending, then they're at greater risk for doing so. We need to have a wider conversation about how we educate our young, particularly in the new digital world that we're in. Mm-hmm. As you say, the later we leave it, well, the less impact it will have.
And I certainly encourage any parents who are watching this, you know, go and find, there's lots of resources now online. Stop It Now, do some really good work and have some very good stuff online. You go and educate yourself in terms of what is available online, how to secure both social media sites, but also be engaging with your children from a very early age as to what isn't appropriate. And, you know, in the same way as parents used to talk about stranger danger, you know, the concept now is not the stranger, it's the person that knows you, it's the person who's in contact with you. And therefore, as parents, we need to do much more to safeguard our children. And I know it's difficult, you know, as a parent, you know, you're limited in time and you think, okay, I'll give them a phone, I'll give them a laptop, or I'll give them an iPad, and it'll just give me some time on my own. We've just got to be aware that actually that is the gateway to great education. You know, the internet is a massive tool, but it's also a gateway to danger.
Yeah, absolutely. A real force for good, but at the same time, real danger, as you say. And, you know, previously we could just close the door, couldn't we, on danger? But actually the danger is now in your own bedrooms or in their bedrooms or in their own house. And I think we've got to have some greater understanding. And yes, parents are quite lazy sometimes. We do need that quality time, and therefore, just go online and leave us alone for an hour or two. No, we need to have a better understanding of what young people are facing and the dangers they're facing, and educate them as well so that they can respond and tell you, they should tell us when they are concerned about something rather than hide it from us because it gets worse.
Absolutely. Let's talk about Sir David Ames, MP. He was killed at his surgery in a Methodist church in Leigh-on-Sea on the 15th of October 2021 last year. He received more than 20 stab wounds. His killer, Ali Harbi, has now been convicted. He stated that he went there pretending to be an NHS employee and that he was moving to the area. We now know he also had a number of other MPs on his target list, including Michael Gove. At his trial, he said he was motivated by a desire to seek revenge against MPs who had voted for airstrikes in Syria. He showed absolutely no remorse. No mitigation was offered at his trial. And he said that he had no regrets or shame, saying, "If I thought I'd done anything wrong, I wouldn't have done it." The court was told that he had planned to die as a martyr because he thought he'd been shot. This was not only horrific, but it just goes to show how terrorism has not only changed, but the very people who are there at the forefront of, you know, politicians, police officers, all those people now, they have a real risk, don't they, on a daily
Absolutely.
Basis.
I mean, the jury took 18 minutes to convict him, which you will know, and I know, is probably some near a world record, really. They were absolutely certain of his guilt. And the questions have been asked. You know, we expect our members of parliament to engage with our communities, to their constituents, their public. They have these surgeries where they allow constituents to come and talk to them. If you remember a few years ago, Stephen Timms MP was stabbed at one of his surgeries, and they brought in some protection, some additional protection for MPs. But generally, MPs, whether it's a church hall or an office, need to leave the door open and allow any constituent to come and see them. And you can't put a barrier in the way. You know, some people were saying, well, we ought to have metal detectors on the way in, and you ought to bag search everybody. Well, that already creates a barrier between the MP and the constituent. But the problem, of course, we've identified in this case is that bad people will do bad things. And poor David Amos, he tweeted the fact that he was going to have his surgery at this event. The murderer was looking for an MP to harm. He was looking everywhere, anybody. In fact, there were dozens of MPs that he in effect was targeting. David Amos put on Twitter that he was having the surgery at this particular day, at this particular venue, at this particular time. And that was really the opportunity then for him to carry out this act. We don't want our MPs to have to hide behind a shield.
That's where it's going, though, isn't it? I mean, I think there has been increase now. You know, Michael Gove and a number of other MPs have talked in terms of wearing a stab-proof vest, having security at surgeries now. I mean, that's where we're heading.
This is a sad world that we're in. You know, I don't want them to have to do that, but I also recognise that their safety comes first. I think as we're learning more about this individual and his history, I think he was being radicalised maybe 10 years ago, 8-9 years ago. He, again, horrible, terrible phrase, he was known to the authorities.
Yeah.
Right? So he was already somebody on their list of people they were concerned about. Now, going back to the broader point about MP security, I think that the MPs should know who they're going to be seeing, and they should have the ability to know what intelligence is out there. So having a blanket, everybody being searched, everybody having to go through metal detectors, et cetera, they should be able to have access to the intelligence to ensure that the people that do see them are not on the lists that the authorities have about people they're scared about or worried about. So I think we need to find a halfway house on this, because I think MPs do need to be able to engage with their constituents. But at the same time, people who are risky, people who are dangerous need to be kept away from them. But additionally, there's a big question to be asked about how it was that this man was allowed to continue to target when he was, quote unquote, known to the authorities.
Mm. And I suppose the problem is that there are so many. I mean, I did quite a bit of work around the target list for security services, MI5, and the list is huge. And
thousands. Resources,
of course, to be able to provide that surveillance. I mean, I don't know if people really understand how absolutely time-consuming and resource-intensive it is to carry out surveillance.
I think
people
seem to assume, we just need to tell them. No, you need 24 people to tell one person. You know, it can't be, just one mark, you follow that person day in, day out. It doesn't work that way. And we have upwards of 25,000 people at various lists, on various lists of people that need to be concerned. We don't have the resources to target and tail everybody. We need to, tail the ones that are high risk, obviously, and ultimately bring them to justice. But we don't have the resources to do this, and we need eyes and ears everywhere. You know, people have shared their concerns about this individual with the authorities. People need to be able to identify people that are greatest at risk who have been radicalized, and then we need to put our resources in relation to those individuals rather than the blanket across everybody.
It's such a hard area for the intelligence services and for the police to be able to stay on top of, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Sir David Amos, I met him once. He was He'd given his life to public service, and he was extraordinarily well received by his constituents and others. Mm. You know, one of the outcomes of his murder was that the Queen gave Southend city status. That tells you a great deal about how well regarded he was. And he was killed doing his job, and we can't forget that. We must, of course, pay tribute to him and give our regards and best wishes and condolences to his family and friends. But we've got to ensure there are no more David Amoses who suffer in the way that he did.
Absolutely. So let's move on and talk about Wakefield MP Imran Khan. So he's been found guilty of sexually assaulting a 15-year-old boy at a party in Staffordshire in January 2008. The allegation, which has now been proven, was that he forced a young man to drink gin, dragged him upstairs, and asked him to watch a pornographic film before sexually assaulting him. During the course of his trial, there was another victim who came forward and said that in a party in 2010, where they both got drunk and smoked marijuana. He had performed a sex act on him. Of course, Khan has denied the offence, and he still maintains that he is innocent, and his lawyers say that he is likely to appeal. There is a twist to this, and that twist is that prior to the trial coming about, he argued that it should be held in secret, arguing that he's a serving MP and that there were concerns about his safety, and that to name him would be to breach his human rights. He also argued, and this is an interesting element, that homosexuality is against the Muslim culture, and therefore that would seriously affect him. He also wanted the boy's age to be withheld. This is a man, of course, who is a public servant. He is an MP trying to hide all of this.
Well, that horrific. Didn't, I mean, that didn't go down very well, did it? You know, anonymity is legally available to all victims of sexual offending. And I can think of a handful of occasions in which it was given to a defendant. I remember one particularly who was in the security services. There are rare occasions. It certainly did not apply to him. And the idea that because homosexuality is against the Islamic faith, that somehow that is another reason for doing so. Well, actually, strange as it may sound, homosexuality is against Christian faith as well. So, the reality is that was a nonsense. It was a terrible attempt to prevent the public confidence, the public having the ability to know what was going on in their courtrooms. He is not entitled to special treatment. No, nobody is when it comes to those who are charged with crimes. You know, we've spent the whole last 40 minutes or so talking about MPs, whether they're breaching COVID regulations, whether they're the victim of terrorist attacks, or whether in this case they are the guilty of sexual offending. We do expect a higher standard from our MPs, but at the same time, let's make it very, very clear, he wasn't entitled to anonymity. I think there were other things as well, Mark. In the immediate aftermath of his guilty plea, another MP, Kristen Blunt, came out with a statement on Facebook saying, "This was a terrible miscarriage of justice," and literally was pretty much attacking the victim rather than the perpetrator. Yeah. He was immediately taken to task. He took down his Facebook statement. He was criticized by members of parliament, by the media more generally, because all that does is dissuade people from coming forward when they have suffered sexual abuse, if they're going to be attacked. A jury who listened to the evidence in this case came to the conclusion that Khan was guilty. And it does not matter, I'm afraid, what you as a friend might think. They heard all the evidence.
And the evidence was clearly overwhelming. And this was a young lad who'd lived with this torment for many, many years. He initially reported it to the police, decided he didn't want to take the matter further forward. It was only when he then became very aware of Khan's continued movement towards becoming a politician and his stance in the community that he felt that actually the time was right now to properly bring him to task. And thankfully so. And I suppose what it does is it tells you very clearly that we don't have a statute of limitation in relation to these types of offences.
No.
And it's really important that people are held to account, even if it's years later.
From your experience, sometimes it's too late. Savile should have been brought to justice during his lifetime. And the fact that he wasn't is a real black mark on our society and our justice system. But 100%, the young man spent half his life thinking about what happened to him when he was 15 years old. And he, as you say, did approach the authorities. He did, in fact, approach, he says, the Conservative Party, and was told nothing would happen or nothing did happen. So, we've got a responsibility as bystanders to stand up and support people who suffer abuse. We sometimes, again, we know this from experience, people take time to finally be able to have the courage to speak up and speak out. But when they do, we should support them 100%. And we can't do what Blunt did, which is the moment that the jury decides that somebody has been convicted, to somehow say, well, actually, the jury got it wrong. Well, yeah, the jury may have got it wrong, but that's not what's happened in this case. The jury listened. You didn't listen. Blunt wasn't there, by the way, during the trial. He turned up for opening speeches and a bit of the defense case. You were there for when the victim had to give his evidence and when he was cross-examined. The jury were, and they reached the verdict that they did quickly.
And of course, Blunt was chair of the all-party parliamentary group for global LGBT plus rights.
Which he resigned from because his deputy chair resigned and others said they weren't going to work with him anymore. You have to ask yourself, these are the best. These are our people that we've elected to lead us, and this is what they do. What can I say, Mark? You know, we deserve better sometimes.
And the heart of this is Khan and Blunt are friends.
Yeah.
They've been friends for a very long time. And it's having the ability to separate professional and friendship at these times, isn't it?
Yeah, there are people that I vaguely knew or acquaintances that ended up being prosecuted for crimes. I stand with the victims. I don't stand with them. You have to draw the line. Let the system do what it needs to do. I think that you simply using, well, he's my mate, and therefore, how many times have, I don't know, again, lots of people provide references for when suspects or defendants are going through a trial. I've known this man for 40 years. He's been lovely, and we've been really nice friends, and he's been good to all his mates. You weren't there when he sexually abused that young boy, so shut up.
Yeah,
I really think that character references really have I personally don't think we should hear them anymore in courtrooms. Yeah. I think they have no value at all.
You're absolutely right. The amount of character references that I've heard in court cases, and you think, well, you weren't there during that period of time. Even Jimmy Savile, he wasn't all horrible all the time. Yeah. There was a lot of the time he's quite normal. And offenders do that. They pick certain periods of time, of course, to do their offending. But they're not going to do it in full view of you,
are they?
And actually, in order to be able to carry out their offences, they have to have some normality about their life. They have to be whatever normal is. They have to carry out that normality.
Yeah.
Blunt also, of course, was former Justice Minister. Does that not add to the whole element of him?
Your first priority, you must do your job. And I think friendship came in the way here. It damages public confidence. It damages victim confidence when people say this kind of stuff. The best thing sometimes, silence is sometimes the best thing. And this is one of those occasions when Blunt and others who came to the support of this individual need to keep quiet. There have been sadly many instances when Charlie Elphick, the MP for Dover, was accused of sexual assault, which he was convicted of. Five Tory MPs gave character references. Five. And he was convicted and sent to prison. Why did they just shut? Why not shut up and let the system do what it needs to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've covered a lot of subjects this week. Obviously, the Partygate still rumbles on. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that. And in relation to Khan, we have yet to hear what his sentence will be. I would hope that it's a fairly lengthy custodial sentence. Yeah, what do you think?
I would think so. I mean, again, just because the years have passed since the crime, it does not mean that the impact this person has lived with, the impact of the sexual assault for 14 years. So I think the judges will take account of that. So I imagine, he's been let out on bail pending sentence, but I can't imagine that it won't be a relatively lengthy custodial sentence.
And of course, he gets no credit because neither did he admit any of the offences in any capacity at all.
Absolutely. Again, people may not understand that you do sometimes get a discount on your sentence depending on when you plead guilty or how early you admit something. The fact that you put this person, the victim, through a trial means that you get no credit at all and you get the sentence you deserve.
Brilliant. Nazir, as ever, an amazing conversation. I find myself every week, I think we just get drawn into the very people that are leading this country, yeah. the very people that we want to or do set the rules, are the very people that break the rules.
I know. I mean, when we came up with the title Without Fear or Favour, we didn't appreciate that was one that everybody was going to be using now. You know, the concept that you've got to, the state must not pay attention to who the person is and just what they did. And as you say a moment ago, you know, I am bewildered really at the state of our country when so many of our leaders drive a coach and horses through the criminal code and decide that the law doesn't apply to them. It does apply to them.
It's very sad, isn't it? I mean, I think you and I have a very strong, high moral compass. We have very ethical and honest approaches. I was talking to someone this week and I said, you know, the backbone of the work I do is around honesty, fairness, transparency. Yet the very people who set those rules, the very people who we are meant to look up to as leading this country, are the very people who break it. And I, you know, it's not just you and I that it affects, but it affects the younger generation. This is where it has the biggest effect.
Well, they look to your leaders. You know, I look to the leaders that I grew up with and think, well, you know, they demonstrated integrity and honesty and truth and transparency. And that's something that is in my DNA because of what I saw around me. But if you see people around you that are just lying and cheating and thinking the law doesn't apply to them and they're committing abuse in the way that some of them have, then I'm afraid that's a message that it sends out to young people, and they will mirror that in their lives.
And if the younger generation are the future, the younger generation are the very people that we need to educate, we need to nurture, we need to mold into the way that they themselves will take forward the honesty,
the mantle. I hope that they look at us and think, we don't want to be like this lot. We want to be honest and truthful, and we've got to hope that that's what happens.
Brilliant. Well, as ever, thank you, Nazir. Thank you for listening to Fear or Favour. Do please keep getting in touch. We hear from you every week and we respond to everybody. So you can contact us via our website, via our Twitter page. Drop us an email and let us know what you think. And please do tell your friends, as many people as possible. Keep listening and let's share the community of Fear or Favour. Until next week, Nazir, you look after yourself.
And you too, Mark.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboo.